We would like to send out a special thanks to Avast for supporting The Trail Went Cold. With Avast One, you can confidently take control of your online world by helping you stay safe from viruses, phishing attacks, ransomware, hacking attempts, and other cybercrimes. Learn more about Avast One at avast.com. Enjoy the show. May 10th, 1996. Brown County, Texas. A burning car belonging to 30-year-old Leon Laurelis is found next to a remote road. Leon's body is lying near the vehicle, and he has been shot through the back of the head. 1 hour earlier, Leon had left his home to drive to work for a shift at a supermarket, but even though his co-workers recalled seeing his car in the parking lot, Leon never entered the store. Since Leon was gay, there is speculation that his murder might have been a hate crime, or he was killed because he saw something he wasn't supposed to, but there are no conclusive answers about what happened. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're going to be exploring a heartbreaking cold case which desperately needs attention, the 1996 murder of Leon Laurelis. I received a request to cover this case from Leon's niece, Arlene Harbison, when I met her at CrimeCon in Las Vegas earlier this year. Arlene has been seeking justice for her beloved uncle for many years, and thus far, his story has been featured on a number of true crime podcasts, including The Fall Line, Gone Cold, The Murder in My Family, Crawl Space, I Said Goddamn, and Texas Wine in True Crime. Over 26 years ago, Leon left his residence in order to drive to work for his midnight shift at a supermarket, but a few hours later, his body was found next to his burning car on a remote road. He had been shot through the back of the head, execution style, and it seemed apparent that one or more perpetrators intercepted Leon when he arrived at his workplace and forced him to travel to the location where he was murdered. The case received very little media coverage at the time, and since Leon was a gay Hispanic man living in a conservative small town in Texas, which was known for having issues with homophobia, there was speculation that this may have been a hate crime. But on the other hand, it's possible that Leon was murdered for reasons completely unrelated to his sexuality, as Leon gave off signs of being concerned about something in the days and weeks prior to his death. Over the years, law enforcement has not been very communicative with Leon's family about the status of the investigation, and at the time of this recording, no one has ever been named as a suspect or a person of interest. There have been a lot of rumors and hearsay surrounding this murder, but very few hard facts. Since Leon's parents and all but two of his siblings have passed away, Arlene Harbison has become the torchbearer for keeping her uncle's story in the spotlight, as she had a closer relationship with him than anyone else from their family, and pretty much considered him to be her best friend. So we're going to do whatever we can to help spread awareness about this heinous crime on today's episode. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the murder of Leon Laurelis. Our story begins in Texas, and our central figure is 30-year-old Juan Leon Laurelis, who goes by the name Leon. Originally born in the town of Mason to parents Frank and Rafaela Laurelis, Leon was the youngest of their nine children as he had four sisters and three brothers, as well as a pair of twin sisters who were stillborn. Leon grew up in the town of Brady, but since the next youngest sibling in his family was 12 years older than him, his brothers and sisters had pretty much moved out when he reached his teen years. During this time period, Leon's father and mother were struggling with various medical issues, so Leon had to assume the role of taking care of them and never got to experience a normal childhood. He was responsible for the cooking and house cleaning, and by the time he was 14, he was already driving his parents around to various medical appointments and picking up their prescriptions. Some of these appointments required him to make four-hour drives to places like Dallas, so this often caused him to miss school. But in an interview with the San Angelo Standard-Times in May of 2021, his niece Arlene Harbison stated, quote, "He never complained. It was just something he took on. He felt like it was his responsibility," end quote. Sadly, Frank passed away in 1985, while Rafaela died 2 years later, but Leon soon wound up devoting all his focus towards his niece. Arlene was the oldest sibling in her own family, and only 2.5 years younger than Leon, so they developed a very close relationship where they felt more like brother and sister rather than uncle and niece. They performed such activities together as dancing and playing in the high school band, and when Arlene gave birth to a baby boy and went through a divorce with her husband, Leon relocated to San Angelo in order to move in with her and help take care of her son while she worked. A few years later, Arlene gave birth to two more sons and relocated to Brownwood, a town with a population of around 18,000 located in Brown County. Once again, Leon agreed to move in with Arlene so that he could take care of her children during the day, but he also got a job as a checker at a local Kroger supermarket where he worked the graveyard shift. By 1996, Leon had moved to the nearby town of Bangs, where he lived with his older brother, George Loralis. He was still working the graveyard shift at the same Kroger store, only he was now an assistant manager, but for the first time in many years, Leon did not have the responsibility of caring for anyone and was able to have a social life and make new friends. He was very well liked by his co-workers, as he would always go out of his way to cover their shifts and buy them gifts on their birthdays and at Christmas. At around 11:30 p.m. on the evening of May the 19th, Leon hopped into his black 1988 Ford Thunderbird and left his residence in order to drive to the Kroger store in Brownwood, where his shift was slated to begin at midnight. But even though the drive only should have taken about 15 minutes, and it was completely out of character for Leon to miss a shift, he never arrived at the supermarket. At 12:27 a.m. on May the 20th, the authorities received a 911 call about a burning vehicle, which had been seen alongside Farm to Market Road 2126 at a spot located about 5 miles south of Brownwood near the entrance to a gun range known as the firing range. When the fire department and deputies from the Brown County Sheriff's Office arrived at the scene, they discovered that the burning vehicle was a Ford Thunderbird and started extinguishing the blaze. Leon's body was lying on the ground a few feet away from the car, and he had been shot once through the back of the head, execution style. Since he was not burned by any of the flames, it appeared that someone had forced him to kneel down before they fired the fatal bullet and set fire to the Thunderbird. It would turn out that some of Leon's co-workers from the Kroger store had recalled seeing his Thunderbird in the parking lot at around 11:45 p.m. that night, less than an hour before the 911 call was placed, and they also said there appeared to be another vehicle parked beside him. By the time Leon's shift started at midnight, he had still not entered the store, so his co-workers checked outside and noticed that the Thunderbird and the other vehicle were no longer parked there. The drive from the supermarket to the spot where Leon's body was found would have taken approximately 12 to 15 minutes, so it was theorized that Leon had been abducted from the parking lot inside his own vehicle or was forced to drive to that location against his will. It also seemed likely that more than one person had to be involved, as the perpetrators would have needed another vehicle in order to drive away from the murder scene. Indeed, at around 12:15 a.m., an eyewitness reported having seen the Thunderbird moving slowly along the shoulder of Farm to Market Road 2126, a short distance away from the firing range. The car was being tailed by a white, late-model flatbed pickup truck, which was possibly a Ford, and it was described as having a gooseneck trailer ball mounted up on the bed. However, all attempts to identify or track down this pickup truck were unsuccessful. The Brown County Sheriff's Office immediately brought in the Texas Rangers to assist them with the investigation, which would be headed by Sergeant Bobby Grubbs. Grubb soon pushed forward the theory that Leon's murder was a hate crime, which came as a complete surprise to his family. You see, even though Leon was gay, he was not very open about it, and the only people he had told were Arlene and a few of his closest friends. Since none of Leon's siblings even knew he was gay, they wondered how Grubbs could have found out in order to form his hate crime theory. Even though Leon seemed to be beloved by everyone who knew him and did not have any known enemies, there were signs that something unusual may have been going on in his life at the time. 2 days before he was killed, Leon told one of his sisters that he was afraid people were mad at him and wanted to hurt him, but he could not understand why, and he did not elaborate on this any further. Unfortunately, the Laurales family would experience another tragedy later that same year when Leon's older brother, Frank Laurales Jr., passed away on November the 6th at the age of 48. While Leon's murder received a bit of local news coverage at the time it originally happened, it pretty much disappeared from the spotlight for years until the Abilene Reporter News ran a story about it in December of 2002. Leon's brother George publicly announced that a $10,000 reward was being offered for information leading to the arrest and conviction of Leon's killer, but he also expressed his dissatisfaction with how the Texas Rangers and the Brown County Sheriff's Office were handling the investigation. George did not believe they had pursued all available leads, stating, quote, "I'm unhappy with law enforcement here. If we're going to bring the person or persons to justice, the information will have to be handed to the investigators," end quote. At one point, the Laurales family had spent $4,000 to hire a Dallas-based private investigator named William C. Deere, who attempted to uncover some new leads. Deere is a bit of a controversial figure who has been involved in some high-profile cases, and we'll talk more about his background later on, but he told the Laurales family that corruption was rampant within local law enforcement, and he had received some death threats. But unfortunately, Deere pretty much broke off all contact with the family and left the area, and to this day, he refuses to discuss the case. The investigation was eventually turned over to the Texas Rangers Cold Case Squad, who worked in conjunction with the Brown County Sheriff's Office. In fact, shortly after retiring from the Rangers, former lead investigator Bobby Grubbs wound up being elected Brown County Sheriff. In July of 2008, Grubbs publicly announced that over the course of the previous year, investigators had taken a fresh look at the case, developing some new information and new leads, and what he described as, quote-unquote, some subjects of interest. Grubbs did not share any specific details, but he believed they were making progress, though one sheriff's investigator, Jimmy Simpson, would describe the case as a, quote-unquote, jigsaw puzzle with multiple pieces. Simpson also stated, quote, "There were persons of interest that the sheriff directed me toward to either get them eliminated as persons of interest or go forward. They have not been able to be eliminated as persons of interest in this case. They are the focal point of the investigation," end quote. In May of 2010, Grubbs commented about the case again during an article in the Abilene Reporter News and stated, quote, "There could be an arrest pending in the future. We just need a little additional information to make it work," end quote. Well, unfortunately, this arrest never took place, as the investigation seemed to hit a standstill and the case once again faded from the spotlight. While serving his third term as Brown County Sheriff, Bobby Grubbs passed away in September of 2015. In recent years, Arlene Harbison has done everything she can to spread awareness about Leon's story and has managed to get it featured in a couple news articles and on some true crime podcasts. However, she has been unable to obtain any of the original case documents or any new information from law enforcement, though the Brown County Sheriff's Office has stated that the case is still open and remains an active, ongoing investigation. Earlier this year, in an interview with the Brownwood TV station, KTAB, Arlene stated, quote, "I've come to terms with the fact that no one will be arrested or indicted for this murder, but I just want answers. I just want to know what really happened to him, and I want to know why," end quote. But after 26 years, the murder of Leon Laurales continues to remain unsolved. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. But before we continue, we would like to send out a special thanks to Avast, as we are very excited that they are now supporting The Trail Went Cold. As you well know, we live in a digital world right now, but one thing which can always be a source of concern is whether or not you have an adequate amount of safety and privacy. Well, this is something that Avast empowers you with no matter who or where you are and how you connect. For the past 30 years, Avast has been the global leader in cyber protection and over 435 million users have placed their trust in it. Avast prevents over 1.5 billion attacks every month. Yes, that's right, 1.5 billion. This is why it's good to enjoy the opportunities that come with being connected on your own terms. Avast has just released a new all-in-one solution called Avast One, which offers a wide range of features to help you gain control of your online safety and privacy. Of course, Avast believes that essential protection is something which everyone should have, which is why the free version of Avast One includes a number of important features, such as free VPN, free firewall protection, and award-winning free antivirus. If you're concerned about privacy, Avast will keep your identity and actions hidden. If you want to conduct business anywhere you want without fear of cybercrime, their VPN allows you to connect safely and securely to public Wi-Fi. If you're concerned about security, Avast will stop malware, phishing, and virus attacks. Their smart scan will find and remove viruses, and you can also use an optimization scan that will resolve any potential privacy and performance issues. Avast Performance products will also clean up and speed up your devices by optimizing the background activity of your apps. I recently installed Avast One on my devices, and it definitely makes me feel a lot more secure, which is particularly useful when you're using all kinds of different resources to research true crime for your podcast. So once again, thanks to Avast for supporting The Trail Went Cold. Confidently take control of your online world with Avast One. It helps you stay safe from viruses, phishing attacks, ransomware, hacking attempts, and other cybercrimes. Learn more about Avast One at avast.com. That's avast.com. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of this episode. So I know it's become kind of a cliche in true crime circles to say that a victim was someone who lit up a room, but in Leon Laralis' case, it sounds like that statement is completely accurate. He has been described as one of the kindest, most generous, and most selfless human beings you would ever want to meet, as he always prioritized others over himself. I mentioned earlier that Leon did not get to experience a real childhood, since he had to spend his teen years taking care of his parents and tending to their various medical issues. And after they both passed away, his top priority was helping to take care of Arlene and her children. But even though Leon never got much opportunity to develop a life of his own, he never complained about it. During an interview at the San Angelo Standard Times last year, Arlene stated, quote, "He stepped in whenever someone needed help. He was such a big, gentle giant," end quote. Overall, Leon was a pretty shy, soft-spoken individual, and definitely not the type of person who would cause trouble or make enemies. So what could have prompted someone to perform an execution-style murder on him? Well, over the past two decades, there have pretty much been two major theories pushed forward. Either Leon became the victim of a hate crime because he was a gay man living in an area which wasn't known for being accepting about that sort of thing, or Leon inadvertently saw, heard, or found out something he wasn't supposed to and was killed for it. Both these theories sound fairly plausible, but there's no conclusive evidence pointing in either direction. While I met Arlene Harbison for the first time in person at CrimeCon earlier this year, she had actually messaged me to share Leon's story on a previous occasion in early 2021. At the time, she was also looking for recommendations for other true crime podcasts who would be a good fit to cover this case, so I directed them towards Gone Cold, since they always shine a spotlight on unsolved cold cases from Texas. In fact, their podcast started out by delivering extensive coverage of the 1974 murder of 17-year-old Carla Walker, and an arrest wound up being made in that case after more than 45 years, so here's hoping that history might repeat itself in this situation. It was also great to see Leon's story get coverage on the Fall Line podcast, which is devoted to bringing attention to cold cases that are often neglected by law enforcement and the media. Indeed, if you try to research Leon Laralis' murder at sites like newspapers.com, you're not going to find all that much material. The news articles which were written when the crime originally took place provide very limited details, and in fact, the May 12, 1996 edition of the Abilene Reporter News even published an obituary for Leon, which erroneously stated that he died after a quote-unquote sudden illness. So even though Leon and Arlene were technically uncle and niece, they were so close in age that they developed a very tight relationship, so she took his death particularly hard. Arlene considers May 10th, 1996 to be the worst day of her life, as she was woken up at around 2:30 a.m. by a phone call from one of her cousins, who informed her that Leon was dead. The only member of the Lorales family that communicated with law enforcement was Leon's brother George, whom he was living with at the time, as the lead investigator, Texas Ranger Sergeant Bobby Grubbs, would not speak with any of the female members of the family. While George was learning about what happened at the Brown County Sheriff's Office, Arlene, her mother, and one of her aunts were forced to wait outside, as no one from the Sheriff's Office would invite them in or even offer any condolences. Later that day, the local newspaper, the Brownwood Bulletin, published an article which reported that Leon had been the victim of an execution-style murder, even though most of his family had not been informed about this yet. This actually prompted Arlene to drive to the Bulletin's office in order to angrily chew them out for publicly sharing that information before Leon's loved ones could find out. Even though Arlene probably knew Leon better than anyone else, law enforcement never requested an interview from her, as it's been suspected that Grubbs did not speak with any of Leon's female relatives because he was just a very old-fashioned guy. Now, in regards to George, he is still alive today, but even though there was a time when he pretty much functioned as the family's official spokesperson, he now refuses to discuss Leon's murder. Arlene and other podcasters who covered this case have attempted to reach out to him about this, but he has never responded. One recurring theme I often see in a lot of these unsolved cold cases is a frustrating lack of communication from law enforcement towards the victim's family. Even though Arlene has requested the case file and other records related to the crime, she has often been given the runaround, and the standard response in cases like this is that law enforcement cannot provide these materials for fear of jeopardizing an active, ongoing investigation. I mean, on the surface, that response does make sense, but it also does not provide much comfort when the case has been unsolved for over 26 years, and there's skepticism about whether any actual investigating is still being done. I'm sure this was especially frustrating back in 2008, when the Brown County Sheriff's Office announced that they had some promising leads and several persons of interest. Hell, 2 years later, Sheriff Grubbs made it sound like an arrest might be taking place in the near future, but after that, there was nothing but dead silence, and Leon's family still has no idea if any of the leads they were pursuing had any significance. So here are some examples of questionable responses Arlene has received when attempting to inquire about key pieces of information from the case. The authorities have always refused to provide Arlene with a copy of Leon's autopsy report, and at one point, the Brown County District Attorney said to her, quote, "Why do you need the autopsy when we all know what his demise was?" Of course, that response has created skepticism that an autopsy was even performed in the first place. The authorities have also told Arlene that they no longer have Leon's burnt-out Ford Thunderbird in their possession, as they claim that the fire damage, as well as the water used to douse the flames, would have eradicated all potential forensic evidence. But even if that were true, one crucial detail which would be useful to know is the position of the driver's seat at the time the car was found. Since Leon was a large person, he would always push the seat all the way back, but if it was found in another position, then this would suggest that another individual drove the vehicle to that location. Law enforcement has also never told Arlene what kind of gun was used as the murder weapon, or if any shells were found at the scene and tested. At one point, Arlene contacted the Brown County Sheriff's Office to inquire about whether they still had Leon's clothing in their possession as evidence, and the only response from the employee she spoke with was, quote, "They've done everything they can with what they have." Yeah, the lack of a simple yes or no answer makes me wonder if they no longer have Leon's clothing, but just do not want to admit it. While it seems unlikely that robbery was the motive for the murder, Leon always carried around a credit card from the Bell's department store chain, which was not among his possessions when his body was found. And even stranger, one of Leon's cousins would learn from the local Bell store that a charge showed up on Leon's credit card from a purchase that was made the day after he was killed. Unfortunately, it does not sound like the store had any surveillance footage available to show who actually used the card, and I suppose an innocent explanation is that since Leon was such a generous guy who often bought gifts for his coworkers at this store, he could have lent the card to someone else prior to his death. But to this day, the card has not turned up, and law enforcement has never publicly offered any comment on this lead in order to verify it. So almost immediately after the murder took place, the Brown County Sheriff's Office brought in the Texas Rangers to assist them with the investigation. It was taken over by Sergeant Grubbs, and it sounds like the actual Brown County Sheriff at that time, Glenn Smith, had very little involvement. From what I've heard, due to jurisdictional issues, it was very out of the ordinary for the Sheriff's Office to have the Texas Rangers take over one of their homicide investigations so quickly, and generally, this sort of thing only takes place if there's some sort of conflict of interest involving local law enforcement. But if that's what happened here, no one has ever officially confirmed it. Obviously, the Lorales family was very taken aback when Grubbs pushed forward the idea that Leon was the victim of a hate crime, since the only family member who knew that Leon was gay at that time was Arlene. I suppose it's possible that Grubbs could have learned this information from other sources, but Leon had only opened up about this to a couple of his closest friends, so it's not like this was common knowledge throughout the area. Since Grubbs has passed away, we may never know where this information came from, but theoretically, if Leon was murdered for reasons that had nothing to do with his sexuality, the hate crime rumors could have been started in order to create misdirection. It's worth noting that one of Leon's co-workers from Kroger has claimed that when the employees were questioned by sheriff's deputies right after the murder, law enforcement was initially pushing forward the narrative that the crime was drug-related. Of course, the co-worker offered a lot of pushback and insisted that this theory was wrong and there was no way Leon was involved in drugs. It almost seemed like the sheriff's office was trying to give off the false impression that Leon brought everything on himself, which meant they wouldn't have to do much investigating. But if so, the ploy did not work, and it was only about a day later when Grubbs completely switched gears and brought up the hate crime theory. When Grubbs retired from the Texas Rangers and became Brown County Sheriff years later, he mentioned in interviews that he was haunted by two cases from Brown County that he worked on and was unable to solve: Leon's case and the 1989 murder of 13-year-old Amanda Goodman. I have no reason to believe that crime has any connection to Leon's murder, but I thought it was worth mentioning here because there are a few striking similarities. On the afternoon of May the 16th, 1989, Amanda was last seen alive while walking home from Brownwood Junior High School, and later that day, a motorist discovered her body in a ditch alongside Indian Creek Road, about 10 miles south of Brownwood. She was shot once in the head, and it appeared that the killer had carefully laid her body on the ground next to her purse and her notebook. Since Amanda was not sexually assaulted, the motive for this crime is still a big mystery, and while no one has ever been named as a suspect, rumors have circulated about one particular individual who was living in the area at the time and then moved to another state months later. There was no way Amanda could have walked to the location she was found on her own, so she obviously wound up in a vehicle at some point with the individual who killed her. So here we have two separate cases from Brown County about victims who were shot in the head in a rural area, and they both left the victim's family in complete shock and perplexed about why these murders happened. While the motive for Leon's murder and the identity of his killer or killers is still a mystery, it's not hard to figure out a possible series of events which led up to the crime. As you recall, Leon left his home in Bangs in order to work the graveyard shift at the Kroger supermarket in Brownwood, but even though Leon's co-workers recalled seeing his Thunderbird in the parking lot shortly before midnight, he never actually entered the store to begin his shift. The co-workers also recalled seeing another vehicle next to the Thunderbird before they both disappeared, so it seems likely that someone who was familiar with Leon's routine either followed him from his residence to the supermarket, or they were already there waiting for him when he arrived. Since Leon was known for being a very responsible person who never showed up late for his shifts, there's no way he would have traveled to that remote spot on Farm to Market Road 2126 unless he was abducted or forced to drive the Thunderbird there at gunpoint. And of course, there had to be more than one person involved, because whoever set the Thunderbird on fire would have needed an additional vehicle to leave the scene. That second vehicle was likely the pickup truck that an eyewitness saw driving along the shoulder of the road behind the Thunderbird shortly before the murder took place. While I'm sure there would be no shortage of pickup trucks in rural Texas, enough distinctive details were provided to the public that I am surprised it's never been identified. Given that the perpetrators went to the trouble of torching the Thunderbird, it is a bit odd that they left Leon's body out in the open and did not place him inside the vehicle if their goal was to destroy potential evidence. But since Leon's death was described as an execution-style murder, perhaps they wanted his body to be found in order to send some sort of message. This location was pretty much out in the middle of nowhere. It was not exactly the easiest location to find, particularly at night, so it was very likely that the perpetrators were locals who were familiar with the area. The decision to murder Leon right next to a gun range may have been a very calculated one, because if any residents heard the sound of a gunshot that night, it would not have seemed overly unusual. Given what ultimately happened to Leon, it's not surprising that certain events which occurred in the days and weeks prior to his death may have taken on a greater significance. I already mentioned that 2 days before he was killed, Leon told one of his sisters that he was afraid people were mad at him and wanted to hurt him, but he had no idea why. Well, the last time Arlene saw Leon alive was when he stopped by the Walmart where she worked on May the 9th, which would have been several hours before the murder took place. However, Arlene did not actually see Leon himself, but rather his Thunderbird, as she noticed it in the parking lot when she was leaving the store at the end of her shift. Even though it wasn't uncommon for Leon to stop by and see Arlene at work, she did find it unusual that his car was parked there and considered walking over to speak with him. But since she was tired, Arlene elected to go straight home, and as you can imagine, she has always been haunted by this decision. Now, given that Leon had told his sister that someone wanted to hurt him, could he have been worried that these same people might try to harm his family? Perhaps the only reason Leon stopped by the Walmart was to keep an eye on Arlene and make sure she left work safely. He may have elected to stay in the vehicle and not approach Arlene because he didn't want to worry her. If it wasn't for Leon's previous comment to his sister, I probably wouldn't place much significance on his car being in the parking lot, but it definitely would have fit his character if he was functioning as a guardian angel over his niece. During the past few years, Arlene has also learned some surprising new information about Leon from one of her cousins, which she did not know before, and it only opens up more unanswered questions. According to this cousin, about a week before the murder, he noticed Leon sitting in his Thunderbird in a parking lot across the street from the Kroger store. When the cousin went over and spoke with him, Leon said he was waiting for his girlfriend to get off work so he could give her a ride home. The cousin then asked Leon why he felt the need to park across the street, and Leon replied that this person's father was a highway patrolman who hated him and had threatened to kill him if he ever saw Leon with her. Now, while girlfriend was the word that Leon apparently used during this conversation, he may have been referring to a female friend rather than someone he was involved in a relationship with. However, another possibility is that Leon deliberately substituted the word girlfriend for boyfriend because the cousin did not know he was gay. Regardless, Arlene says she cannot think of any Kroger employees at that time, male or female, whose father was a highway patrolman. But if what Leon said was true, why did this man want to kill him? Did he have a hatred towards Leon because he somehow found out he was gay? Could the highway patrolman been one of the people that Leon was referring to when he said that someone wanted to hurt him and he had no idea why? Well, believe it or not, this isn't the only strange encounter this cousin had with Leon during the last week of his life. 2 days before the murder, the cousin claimed that he noticed Leon at a local park speaking to a guy in a red car who seemed a bit suspicious. When the red car left the park, the cousin soon found himself facing the vehicle while they were parked at opposite stop signs at an intersection. The cousin said that he pointed at the driver as a signal to let him know that he saw him, and he soon turned around so he could make an attempt to follow the red car. However, he then saw that the red car had been stopped by another vehicle being driven by two men who looked like they might be police officers, and they proceeded to speak with the driver for a few minutes before they let him go. The cousin then went to the park and asked Leon who the guy in the red car was, and Leon told him it was a friend who worked as a doctor at a hospital. Since the cousin had recently gotten out of jail, he was living in a halfway house at the time, but in the days following Leon's murder, he said that two men calling themselves investigators suddenly showed up there to question him. Well, it turned out these were the same two men he had seen at the park speaking with the man in the red car. The cousin had no idea how these investigators found him, since very few people knew he was staying at the halfway house, but he proceeded to tell them about the man in the red car. The investigators left them a phone number, but whenever the cousin attempted to call them in order to follow up on what was going on, he was unable to get a hold of anyone, and they never called him back. In retrospect, the cousin now wonders if these two so-called investigators were even affiliated with law enforcement. Arlene says that she does not have any idea who this doctor friend of Leon's could have been, and who knows if this incident has any connection to the murder. But the way the cousin describes them, this whole series of events sounds very bizarre. Why did these two men just happen to be near the park when Leon met up with this other guy? You might be thinking that perhaps Leon was having a secret meeting with a man he was romantically involved with, but it turned out that Leon was already seeing someone else at the time. And this person was not a doctor, but rather a high school teacher slash coach from Leon's former hometown of Brady. It seems like the only person whom Leon confided in about this relationship was another gay man named Steve Harris, a local business owner and activist who has always been very outspoken about the atmosphere of homophobic intolerance that gay people have had to deal with in Brownwood. According to Harris, shortly before he was killed, Leon told him that he had secretly been seeing this high school teacher and was ready to come out about the relationship, but his partner was not, as this was the sort of thing which could have caused him to lose his job. Leon had pretty much reached the point where he did not want to keep the relationship going if he was forced to remain in the closet, so he was prepared to end things if his partner wasn't willing to come out. Sadly, this teacher passed away just under 2 years ago, so he never spoke to Leon's family or made any public comments about the situation. It's already been mentioned that since Leon devoted most of his youth to caring for other family members, he did not get the opportunity to have much of a social life until he reached his 20s. Once he started attending more parties, he was able to interact with different friend groups that were outside his usual social circle, and he reportedly became acquainted with a clique who had nicknames like the Brownwood Mafia and the Northeast Posse. This group consisted of three men who had been friends for quite some time, and one of them was the son of a fairly prominent member of the Brownwood community. There were always rumors and gossip that the group was known for causing trouble and possibly being involved in illegal activity. Leon was definitely not the type of person who would have had any interest in participating in illegal activities, but if he started spending time around these people, could he have seen or heard something which put his life at risk? We have no way of knowing for certain, but there are a number of signs to indicate that Leon was concerned about something prior to his death. So now's a good time to talk more about William C. Deere, the private investigator the Lorellis family hired. As you recall, he shared some cryptic remarks about rampant corruption in local law enforcement and mentioned that his life was in danger before he broke off all contact with the family. I will admit that my eyebrows were raised when I first heard Deere's name, because he has associated himself with a wide range of high-profile cases, so much so that he even has his own Wikipedia page. And by wide range, I'm talking about everything from the exhumation of Lee Harvey Oswald and the infamous alien autopsy film that was a pretty big phenomenon during the 1990s. He has also published a few books, the most controversial of which is titled O.J. is Innocent and I Can Prove It, which explored the possibility that the real killer of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman was O.J. Simpson's son, Jason Simpson. Deere has a personal website devoted to himself with a section titled Renowned Investigations, and it lists all the cases he has worked on. Yes, Leon Lorellis' murder is on the list, but I question how much work he actually did on this case besides taking the family's money and skipping town. Now, it is possible that Deere did provide a report to George Lorellis about what he found during his investigation, but if this report exists, George has never shown it to Arlene or anyone else from the family. He has also never discussed its contents, and like I mentioned earlier, George no longer talks about this case at all. All that being said, if Deere was telling the truth and really did uncover evidence of widespread corruption which put his life at risk, then I can only imagine what the motive might have been for Leon's murder. Like I mentioned in the intro, Leon's loved ones have been kept in the dark for so long about so many things that we have a lot of unconfirmed rumors and hearsay surrounding this case, but very few hard facts. I hearken back to that comment from Brown County Sheriff's Investigator Jimmy Simpson in 2008, where he referred to the case as a quote-unquote jigsaw puzzle with multiple pieces. Well, with the information we have right now, it definitely feels that way. There are a number of theories and a lot of speculation, but the pieces just don't quite fit together. What does seem clear is that this was a calculated, premeditated murder, and that multiple individuals had to conspire to pull it off. But why would anyone want to do this to such a kind and generous person who never harmed anybody or caused any trouble? Of course, if the murder was a hate crime, then we already know what the motive was, but we still can't be 100% certain that's what happened. It's unclear if there's any physical evidence in this case to work with, so it's possible that the best chance we have for this crime to get solved is if someone comes forward with information. While there may have been a culture of fear which compelled people to remain silent back in 1996, the more time that passes, the better chance there is that this fear may subside and compel people to share what they know. At this point, it's been 26 years, and many members of Leon's immediate family have passed away, but his surviving loved ones deserve some justice. Even if the individuals who committed this crime are never charged or serve any time in prison, Arlene would still like to receive some answers about what happened. But the good news is that the true crime podcasting community is doing everything they can to spread awareness about Leon's story, as the case has gotten more coverage these past 2 years than at any other point during the past 2 decades. Just under a few weeks before this episode's release, an auction was held in which over 25 true crime podcasters donated items to be part of a merchandise bundle, which would be auctioned off to the highest bidder. The money they paid would then be donated to a GoFundMe page to help Arlene with such expenses as hiring a new private investigator and commissioning a memorial mural to be painted in Leon's honor. We will be providing a link to this GoFundMe page in our show notes. In another great piece of news, a new billboard is being erected in Brownwood featuring Leon's photo and contact information for people to send in tips about the crime. The billboard campaign has been funded by the board of directors at Season of Justice, so it will remain up there in Brownwood for at least a full year. So perhaps one day, the right person will see it and finally come forward with the information needed to solve this case. Anyway, a special thanks to Arlene Harbison for bringing Leon's story to this podcast, as she is an amazing advocate who deserves justice for her uncle. So if you happen to have any information about the murder of Leon Laurelis, please contact the Brown County Sheriff's Office at 325-646-5510. That's 325-646-5510. Or you can also call the Heart of Texas Crime Stoppers tip line at 1-800-222-TIPS. That's 1-800-222-8477. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, I released a bonus episode about an odd case from Unsolved Mysteries, the story of Dan Tondevold, a mysterious con artist who swindled the wealthy socialite out of her fortune before he supposedly killed himself in what may have been an attempt to fake his own death. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, cover yet another case from Unsolved Mysteries, the 1971 murder of an unidentified Jane Doe known as Little Miss Panasofsky. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon these past few weeks, and they are Laura N., Melissa D., Matthew P., and Jen M. Thank you all so much for your support. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourselves a good week, and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold.